the clothing that had been cut off.
Will he live? Persephone asked.
Anival nodded. After a fashion, I suppose. Primus Noch, report, Nephron barked. Persephone was taken aback by his forceful address to a man barely clinging to life, yet her husband knew the soldier's name better than she. Nock's eyes fluttered and slowly lifted.
Sir,
I said report. Why are you here? What happened to your men? Where is First Primus Adam?
Eaten, sir.
No matter what they were doing, everyone in the tent paused. Did you say eaten?
Yes, sir.
Nock managed through cracked and bleeding lips.
Goblins, sir. Thousands of them. We saw their ships. Black sails on the water. Huge things. Like floating cities. None of us ever saw the like. Then the boats disappeared.
Corey, a melon woman, placed a warm cloth to his head, and Nock jerked.
Leave him alone, woman! Nephron snapped. Nurse him later!
He turned his attention back to the soldier. Go on with your report. What happened then? Did you reach the river?
Yes, and it was beautiful. Seen from the bottom, the falls are...
I don't care about the view, man. What happened?
We found a good spot and set up camp. Cut trees to make a clearing. The first Primus planned to use the logs to make a platform bridge to get across. We were all in high spirits. The river was so calm. We thought we were looking at the end of the war. Then the sun went down. Darkness came, and so did the goblins. They were all around us. Couldn't see them. But we heard their chattering in the dark. They stayed away from our fires. But all night long we heard cries as they took our scouts. Next day we found...
His eyes closed as he trailed off.
What?
Nephron shook him awake.
Bones. Piles of bones, as if they'd had a pig roast. But these weren't from no boar. All day long the first Primus worked us hard to make rafts. He figured if we could get across the river, we'd be safe. But the river widens out as it becomes the Green Sea.
He shook his head.
No, not the Green Sea. The Goblin Sea. They own it, every square inch. More ships came. We planned to cross the river at first light, but that night they burned our rafts and took more men. By morning we saw a new forest. This one was on the water. Masts from all their ships. That's when the first Primus ordered me and 10 others to leave. To try and slip through their lines to come back here and report. As I crept out, I saw shadows in the trees. The whole place was moving. I still don't know how I managed it. Got lost, slept in a cave, didn't dare make a fire. How many others made it, sir? How many besides me got back?
Nephron looked at Persephone briefly, then turned so abruptly that his blue cape whirled. Without answering Nock, he walked out. The soldier shifted his worried eyes to Persephone.
You need to rest now, she told him. Take care of him, will you?
She asked Anival, before she too left, following her husband.
They're all dead,
Nephron told her as soon as they were clear of the healing quarter. He led her away from the hub of the camp. She didn't think he had a destination in mind. He just wanted to be anywhere else. All around them, the camp was a hive of activity as people hauled boxes and sacks out of the tents. Their slumping shoulders screamed of defeat.
So no others returned?
Nephron shook his head.
Half of the Second Legion. 1,000 men. Gone. And they weren't even fighting our enemy. What a waste.
They passed a group of men using a pry stick to unfasten a primary tent peg. Two were already free, and the canvas had fallen. Inside the deflated canvas, the main pole listed and threatened to fall. "You can't retreat." Malcolm's words rang loud in her head. "You must stay here. Nephron especially."
"Nephron, I..." "The worst part is that Malcolm predicted it," he said. "Well, no. The worst part is losing so many troops for nothing.
But still, having him be right adds that special twist of the knife."
"Malcolm did what? When?"
"Just after I sent them off. He even said it would be the goblins, and that the men would be eaten." Together, they reached the end of the road where the snow went deep. "You're not going to like what I'm about to say," she said.
"Then maybe you shouldn't."
He offered her a half-hearted smile. "What is it?"
"We can't leave. We have to stay here."
"What? Why?" Persephone bit her lower lip. "Malcolm just told me that if we move, even a short distance, we'll lose the war." Nephron let go a sad imitation of a laugh. He gestured with his arms toward the camp.
"Look around, Persephone. We already have.
Then what good will it do to retreat?" "Stalemate," he said. "You're right about the cost of making more dragons. Death among the Frey is rare, and as such harder to accept. It could become too high a price for Lothian to bear. Besides, retreating is doing something. It's better than just sitting here and waiting for death to descend upon us."
"But Malcolm, he says we can still win. And all that we have to do is just stay here."
"I don't see how that's possible, do you?"
"No, but he knew about the goblins, and he knew about Suri's capture before she was even sent, and he knew about Nolan's birth. He said I would have a son."
"That's hardly remarkable. He had a 50-50 chance of being right."
"He told me that my child would be born on the banks of the Burn River and the High Spear Valley."
"I still don't see..."
"He predicted it while we were still in Alunrist and you were chasing Lothian. At the time, I wasn't sure if you would return. He knew you'd make it back and that you'd be moving our position and where it would be. He knew we would wed even before I made my final decision."
Nephron had no response to that. Instead, he looked out across the white expanse into the infinite, his breath making tiny clouds that vanished as quickly as they formed.
"I think we should stay," she said, making the decision as she spoke the words.
"That's incredibly risky. It will mean our deaths if Malcolm is wrong."
"Since when are you afraid of death?"
"You weren't there," he said in a deadly serious tone that was aided by the frigid air and bleak landscape. "You didn't see what Lothian did to my father in the Carfrain Arena. He wanted to make an example of what happens to those who defy him. Sepheron was a good and a proud Frey, and he followed the law. He exercised the right that our society, that our God, granted him. Lothian could have given him an honorable death. Instead, he turned my father into a puppet, made him defile and mutilate himself before all of Erevan. He died slowly, painfully, forced to eat his own fingers before a vomiting crowd. That's what Lothian did to a law-abiding citizen who dared to challenge his authority. What do you think he'll do to us?" The wintry wind blew a cold chill between them. He sighed. "We'll stay for now, if you want. But the day we see the Fane's army assembling on the eaves of the forest, accompanied by dragons, that's when we must leave, and I don't care what Malcolm says."
Chapter 8. The Past and the Future. Continuing to fight against insurmountable odds is difficult, even insane. But giving up was the hardest thing I have ever done. The Book of Bryn.
Brown had been studying one of the stone tablets when she stopped, looked up, and stared off into the dark, as if listening for something.
"What's wrong?" Bryn asked.
"Hmm?"
Ron blinked her way back to reality, at least their present version of it. She looked down at the tablet before her, as if she'd forgotten what she was doing.
"Oh, nothing. I was just thinking that this symbol here has to make the same sound as this one."
She pointed at the markings.
"And this one, and this too. They all make the same sound, but they're all different symbols."
Bryn smiled and nodded.
"I call it the schwa. It's the most important sound people make when talking. A short, quiet one, almost never stressed.
But yeah, in order to capture it in writing and have the rest make sense, it requires some flexibility, and varies depending on the adjacent symbols."
"A lot of the sounds come from the same markings, at least in combination.
These sets, here,"
she pointed again,
"they're identical. Yet for the phrase to make sense, they would have to be pronounced differently."
Bryn nodded, bit her lip, and made an embarrassed face. Her system wasn't without its flaws. She knew that, and this was the first time anyone had ever studied it. The first time it had ever been taken apart and critiqued. Teaching Roan to read had become an act of humility.
"Look at this," Roan went on. "I understand why the markings for the words hive and five are nearly the same, but why is give also similar?
It doesn't sound the same at all. And here, low and how, same thing.
And this set of symbols, these can be pronounced eight different ways. Isn't that right?"
Again, Bryn nodded, thinking,
"Maybe teaching someone to read wasn't such a good idea. I sort of imagined it would be fun. While Tressa never learned much, at least she never made me feel like an idiot."
"And these symbols that appear at the end, they set the timing, right? When the thing happened, in the past, the present, or the future?"
Bryn nodded.
"So why are there eight? And why are there so many of these items added in front of words that designate the opposite of the thing that follows?
There should only be two states, but again, you have eight. Unimportant, illogical, disagree, and so on. You seem to have a thing for eight."
"It's just how people talk," she defended herself. "I didn't invent the language."
Bryn had invited Roan to search through the scattered set of tablets, looking for any information on how to escape. Neither of them could move the stones, so several couldn't be read, and none could be reordered. As a result, Bryn went around the chamber on her hands and knees, reading all the ones she hadn't had a chance to go over on her first visit. Teaching Roan to read gave the Wizard of Nog something to work on. Bryn hoped it would help her recover. The speed at which the woman grasped ideas was astounding. In a world of mental sloths, Roan was a diving peregrine. Problems, however, came given the way Roan's mind worked. She wasn't the type to accept what was. She always focused on whys and hows.
"But if you are going to make a system, why not make it the best? Why not clean it up, standardize?"
Bryn shrugged, because everyone already knows how to talk. It's been difficult to get Tressa to learn while using words she already knows. If I'd tried to make her use new words like undecisive or unpossible, it would have been a lot harder.
"Hmm."
Roan's single tone sounded judgmental, disapproving. Bryn felt altogether miserable. The written language was her one thing, her life's achievement. She'd spent years creating, refining, and polishing the system. It was the achievement she was proudest of, at least until a moment ago.
"Maybe it's best that I never taught anyone else. Apparently, it's a mess."
Roan sat back and sighed heavily, a scowl on her face. She hates it. Roan hates what I created. I'm tired, Roan said. I need to rest. Being up like this is exhausting. I feel like we've gone back in time. Like Arion is draining us again.
Bryn nodded. Roan slowly stood and began to walk back toward the others, to Gifford, leaving Bryn alone. After a few steps, she stopped.
It's beautiful, though. What is?
Bryn asked.
Your writing. It's an amazing thing you've created. I wish I could study more of it. I wish I had more strength. It's wonderful.
Bryn felt her heart swell so much it pushed tears to her eyes.
Thank you.
Then, feeling uncomfortable under the weight of such massive praise, Bryn sought an escape.
I don't think I did much. The person who wrote these tablets did most of the work.
Malcolm thinks he saw me in the future and used my own system. Truth is, the Ancient One filled in some gaps, improved what I was trying to do, and made me see what was possible.
Maybe, Roan said.
But even without the tablets, you would have figured it all out eventually. Or those who you taught would have. How else could he have learned this? He must have seen the language you eventually made. You taught him first.
Roan left her alone with that idea to ponder, and another score of tablets yet to read. Tesh knew what he had to do. He just wasn't sure he could manage it. They'd all agreed it was the only way, and that he was the man for the job. He'd faced deadly fray in the Harwood, fought Sebek and whatever a row was, but none of those things had scared Tesh as much as the battle he was about to wage, one he couldn't afford to lose. But deep down in his selfish depths, he hoped he might. He knew victory would be bitter. It would hurt more than anything he'd previously experienced, and last an eternity. Still, he had to do it. Tesh walked across the cave, feeling like he was going to his execution while carrying the weight of the world. His feet dragged across the stone, and his arms hung as if boulders swung from his wrists. He didn't have the will to lift them. He didn't have arms or feet either, but he was past trying to understand such things, beyond caring. This place was killing what was left of him. Soon, very soon, standing and walking would become things he used to be able to do. Finding Bryn was easy. She shone out as a beacon in the dark, and he noticed that the closer he got, the lighter he felt. Something about Bryn had a way of lifting his load, now and always. She was sitting on the floor near a wall with dozens of flat tablets gouged with markings strewn about. She was doing her reading thing. Tesh had never understood, but he knew it was important to her. She hadn't seen him yet, and he paused while still several yards away. Crossing the cave was exhausting, and he needed a rest before taking those last difficult steps. But he also wanted to look. Take her in. She was beautiful. Never more so than at that moment. She leaned over a tablet, studying it with her fingers as well as with her eyes. I never deserved her. He'd been telling himself that for some time. He thought it might make his quest easier. It didn't. A mouse, trapped in a corner by a bear, will still fight for survival. Love, he came to realize, was like that. No matter the odds, love refused to give up. That's what made those last few feet so hard. What made any and all excuses useless. Bryn, he said softly. Her head came up. She drew back the curtain of hair, saw him, and smiled. Don't do that. Please don't smile at me. Tesh could feel the pain again, deep in the place where his chest used to be.
I never thought I'd find these tablets again. Roan and I have been reading them, trying to find something that can help us get out.
She pointed at the one she had been working on.
The ancient one. The being whom the dwarves let out of the agave. Wasn't a prisoner at all. I mean, well, he was, but he was dead, just like us. His name wasn't The Three, it was Trylos.
You can see how I made that mistake, right?
I'm still trying to figure out how these tablets were made. Nothing I've eaten can affect anything in Alan. Unless...
Bryn lifted the key, which now hung around her neck.
I bet I could scratch on stone with this. I wonder if he had something like it. Anyway, Trylos was in the abyss, and he managed to get out. Out of this cave, out of the abyss, out of the afterlife, or the afterworld, as he called it. He's probably the only one to have ever done that, and he did it without a key. How? I don't know exactly. I can't read all of the tablets. Trylos wrote on both sides, and I can't turn them over or move them. That means there is still a lot of missing information, but I've learned a lot. You see, Trylos, an Asira, was murdered by his brother. He was the first ever to die.
Asira, Tesh said. Isn't that one Fenelius called Feral? Bryn nodded.
According to Beatrice, she's a dwarven seer we met. There were five Asira. Turin, Trylos, Feral, Drome, and Mara. Trylos was the first to die, and he became the first inhabitant of Pyre, aside from the Typhons.
Who?
According to these tablets, they were spoiled brats with the power of the elemental forces of nature. When they lived on the face of Elan, the Typhons ripped the place apart, destroying everything they came in contact with. It's one of the reasons Eton hated them. Eventually, they were cast into Pyre. The Typhons' continued efforts to escape are still felt on Elan in the form of earthquakes. They're the ones that made this tunnel, probably trying to dig their way out. But there's a barrier between Elan and Pyre that even they couldn't get through.
Bryn, I'm glad you found the tablets. I can see how much you enjoy this stuff, but I...
Oh, you have no idea.
She pointed toward a tablet a few feet away.
From that one, I learned that the abyss was created to hold the Typhons, but the shackles strong enough to restrain them were harmful to an Asira and devastating to the likes of us. So, Elan created an upper tier to Pyre, the low plains of Nifril, the midlands of Rel, and the highlands of Alison. This gave her children a place where they could live comfortably. Anyway, Trylos wasn't alone long. With the First War, others died, and as Trylos's siblings joined him, he learned the tragic truth that Turin had given the gift of eternal life to his daughter, Muriel.
Why is that so bad?
Because she and Trylos were in love. The tablets are filled with his thoughts and memories of Muriel. Oh, I even found the message Padera gave me.
Padera?
She died. We found her in Rel, and she said Malcolm told her to tell me when trees walk and stones talk.
At the time, I didn't know what that meant,
but I found it in the tablets. It's a phrase Muriel uses when she's frustrated that something will never happen.
She paused there and shook her head.
When I think of the cruelty, it's no wonder Muriel hates her father so much.
I'm not following you.
Oh. Well, Muriel is immortal, so she can never come to Pyre, but Turin killed Trylos to keep the two of them apart. When Trylos found out Muriel would never be joining him, he threw himself into the abyss. The tablets don't actually say why. Maybe he thought there would be a way out down here. Or it could be he was hoping the Typhons would obliterate him from existence. But then he found this tunnel and the thin barrier between the two worlds. This gave him hope. The Typhon's brute force wasn't able to breach the barrier between the two worlds. But Trylos found a way. Rather than bashing a monster-sized opening, he chose to focus on creating a teeny tiny pinprick, just big enough for a bodiless spirit to pass through. But he faced two problems. The first was that he lacked the power to break through the barrier, even with a small hole. The second was that he would still be buried under layers and layers of rock. Eventually, the dwarfs provided a solution. He heard them burrowing and called to them, promising secrets in return for his release. That's how he got out of Pyre.
And you got all that from these tablets?
Tesh stared at the scattered stones.
Yeah.
But you didn't actually find anything that can get us out?
Well, no.
And you read all the tablets, right? All the ones I could.
Like I said, I can't...
Bryn, I have to tell you something, and you're not going to like it.
He paused and licked his lips. His head drooped from the weight. He had to get this done while he still had the strength. She turned to face him fully, and her light was blinding. He wanted to lift a hand to shield his eyes, but that wasn't going to happen, so he turned away.
Bryn, the others and I have been talking, and we've made a unanimous decision. You have to go on without us.
Go on?
What do you mean, go on?
There was a harsh, suspicious bite to her tone. She knew exactly what he meant.
You can climb up. You can reach the door to Allison. You can finish what we can't.
With a nervous laugh, she shook her head.
I can't do that. Not alone. We all have to get out of here. I can't just leave you all.
Not here.
Oh, dear Alan, no. I can't leave you here.
Tressa told us what Malcolm said. That you, and only you, would make it all the way through.
I think Tressa might be suffering from...
Look at us, Bryn. I know you thought we'd get better, but you know we won't. The longer we're here, the more we are drained. You have to leave us behind. And...
No! Rowan will figure out some brilliant solution. Or we'll find another tunnel made by the Typhons that isn't blocked. Or...
Bryn, all those things take time.
So? We have plenty of that. We have eternity.
Tesh took her anger as a good sign. If she thought he was spouting nonsense, she would have laughed. Instead, she barked at him, her face twisted up, showing teeth. It hurt to see that expression, to know he was causing her pain. Tesh had become acutely aware of such things. He was a raw wound, sensitive to what he did and what he caused. It was a shame he'd only recently acquired this talent. Gritting his teeth, he pressed on.
We don't have a lot of time, and you know it.
If you don't go now, you'll never be able to.
What do you mean? We've all noticed. You're growing dimmer.
Don't try to deny you're not starting to feel the effects of the Abyss. How much longer before you're like Roan? Then me, and eventually like Tressa.
Bryn looked at her hand self-consciously, then set her jaw.
I'm not leaving.
She was shaking her head, and Tesh reached out.
Bryn, you...
No, she shouted, and jerked away. She stepped back, nearly falling.
You have to, Tesh said as gently as he could.
No, I don't! Don't have to.
You're the only one who can. At the very least, the key has to be taken up.
If this was only about Suri, I might concede, but we're talking about the fate of the world.
Tressa explained it all.
Malcolm might be wrong.
Her mouth folded up in a hateful, hurtful, determined pucker.
Bryn.
Tesh fought to find words, struggled to talk. His tongue was working against him. He didn't want to speak. He didn't want her to leave. He was shredding his insides with every word he uttered.
If I leave you...
Bryn's eyes grew moist, the beginnings of tears brimming.
The weight of this place will...
Tesh, it will crush you, melt you, make you into...
You don't know. I've seen some of the people who've been here too long. They're...
Tears slipped free and ran down her cheeks. With her glow shining through, they sparkled like diamonds. Dear Mara, she's beautiful.
More than anything, he longed to grab her, hug her, hold her, and agree to stay together forever. He wanted to melt away with Bryn, become one person. He could accept his fate if she was with him.
Summoning all the strength he had left, he said, "You don't belong here, Bryn. Not with us. Not with me."
"Don't say that!"
"It's true. Look at you. See the light you give off? You deserve better."
"I don't deserve anything."
"And you're just trying to make me go because..."
She put a shaking hand to her mouth to rest on quivering lips. Her whole body jerked and shook.
"Tesh, I love you. Leaving you, oh, grandmother, leaving you here in this place, you'll lose yourself. That's what's happened to those horrible blobs that chased me. The abyss, this place, it isn't for people like us. We can't endure it. The pressure, the weight that it exerts crushes, erodes, and wears away the very understanding of ourselves until..."
She shuddered.
"I can't abandon you to waste away, to dissolve. I can't do that. I can't. I won't."
Tesh had battered her weak, forced her shield aside, clubbed her sword away. Bryn was exposed for the thrust that he had been leading up to. He didn't want to do it, and the pain flashed hot and sharp in his chest even as he opened his mouth. Tears slipped down his own cheeks, and he hated himself for knowing they would only serve to drive his blow deeper. He would win this battle, slay his opponent, and then hate himself for all eternity. But he had to do it for everyone. But mostly for her.
"Bryn," he said, his words so soft that they barely overcame her weeping. "You once told me that the only way I'd ever lose you is by refusing to let you go. You were right. I had a hard time seeing it then because I cared so much. I love you, Bryn. We all do. The question is, do you love us? Do you love us enough to let us die?"
Her weeping turned to a sob.
"Bryn, you have to let us die the same way I had to let you. Don't you see? You have to let us go."
He saw it then. Her light flickered. It blinked hard. In her eyes, through those windows to her soul, he saw her break. He'd seen the same look on men in the instant of their deaths. Shock, pain, resignation. Tesh had won, as he'd known he would. Bryn would leave, taking her light away and leaving them in darkness. But none more so than Tesh. And he was certain she was right. Seeing her go would crush him.
"Oh, Tesh."
Bryn fell to her knees.
"Tesh, it hurts so much."
"I know. Believe me, I know."
Chapter 9. The Climb. Extended trips are the most frightening to begin. Sheer cliffs, the most difficult to climb. Long falls, the most painful to endure. But it is invisible chains that are the hardest to break. The Book of Bryn.
"Well?"
Tressa asked when Tesh and Bryn returned to the others. Tressa and Roan looked like dead bodies left to be picked over by crows after a massive battle. Each was propped up against the cave wall on either side of Gifford, as if he were a campfire, one that had burned down to coals. Like everyone else, he, too, was dimming.
"She'll do it," Tesh told them.
"But you can't give up,"
Bryn added. Her cheeks were dry, but her eyes were puffy and red.
"You have to promise me that you'll keep looking for a way out. You especially, Roan,"
Bryn pointed at her.
Maybe I missed a tablet, or I read something that meant nothing to me but could provide you with an answer.
Roan didn't look capable of much more than clinging to Gifford's arm.
You have to think. Put that imaginary hair into your non-existent mouth and chew harder than you've ever done before. There has to be a way. There's always a better way.
In the world of the living, maybe, Tressa said. But no one can cheat death.
Bryn glared at her.
You and your husband once told everyone in Dalren that you can't fight the gods. Remember? Maybe you don't. But I do.
She poked her own chest with a finger.
Keeper of ways. I don't forget anything. You once asked Persephone, will you have us take up spears against the Grandmother Elan for not sending sufficient rain this year? The finest warriors of this village couldn't defeat a bear, and you expect us to make war with the Frey? And then Conniger added, men can't kill gods. Well, guess what, Tressa? We didn't just kill those gods, we've nearly wiped them out. So don't lie there and tell me what can and can't be done. For starters, I'm about to cheat death. I'm going to climb that pillar, something no one has ever done. I'm coming back from the abyss. But I won't do so unless I get pledges from each and every one of you that you won't give up, that you'll keep trying. Understand?
I'll accept your condition. With one of my own, Tesh told her. I promise to keep trying, but only if you promise not to hold out hope. If we make it, so be it. But I want your word that you won't expect it. You have to let us go. And Bryn, if you can manage it. If you cheat death and somehow find your way back to a life under the sun, I want you to forget me and find a new life, a new love.
She was shaking her head again, her jaw locking down.
I can't possibly.
You have to, Bryn. You need to accept that I'm dead, that we all are. If you get out, you really need to get out. Don't leave any part of you behind to suffer. If I can believe you're free, truly free, living happily somewhere, then that will be my reward. My little comfort to hold on to here in this place. My sacrifice will have been worth it. Do you understand?
Bryn nodded.
Then I swear, by my deceased parents and my lost tribe, that I'll try and keep trying.
Bryn looked to all of them and received similar assurances.
And by the way, Tressa, I forgive you.
No, you don't. You can't. You don't know all the things I've done.
Tressa was holding her lips in a tight frown.
Bryn nodded. Maybe not, but I can forgive you for destroying my pages. And whether you believe me or not, I already did. And a long time ago.
She rolled her shoulders.
As for the lies that brought us here, I don't know how it all works. But you came knowing you'd be sacrificing your own life. That has to count for something, you know. People change, Tressa. I think you have. Or maybe you've always been a good person, but the world never gave you the chance to show your true colors. Either way, I see them now. And I think you're something. Something special. And that's why you're as bright as a morning star,
Tressa said. Bryn gave Tressa a tight hug and kissed the sobbing woman goodbye. Gifford was the only one to walk out with her, the only one who could. The rest stayed anchored to the floor of the cave. She said her goodbyes to everyone but Tesh. In the end, she couldn't face him. She knew if she tried, she wouldn't have the strength to leave. He seemed to know it as well, and kept his distance. That was for the best. Even so, if it hadn't been for Gifford pulling her free of the cave, she might not have left. The potter walked with Bryn to the base of the column. Black, cracked rock with angled strata of varying shades of grey rose up,
a great pointing finger, or massive stone tree. Yes, a tree.
Bryn wanted to think of it that way. She would simply be climbing a tree, like when she was a girl. Walking to the base, she placed a hand on the stone.
This is it.
She wiped tears from her cheeks. Gifford looked up and nodded.
You can do this, Bryn.
You could, too.
Gifford didn't answer.
You know you can. The weight afflicting the others has less of a hold on you.
He reached out and laid his own hand on the rock and nodded.
You and I guess we didn't have enough opportunity to get into too much trouble.
He smiled at her, and she missed the old lopsided grin.
Turns out, not having much of a life has its advantages. We could do it together, Gifford.
He shook his head.
You know I can't.
You could.
I won't.
His voice was firm and stern. Bryn sighed.
If Roan had died, you'd have to go on without her. This is like that.
Gifford shook his head.
You remember your Aunt Nida's dog, Apple?
Bryn nodded.
My Uncle Gelston said my aunt ruined him, that all he was good for was following Nida around.
He couldn't herd at all.
What did Apple do when your aunt died?
You're not a dog, Gifford.
That dog stayed at her grave day and night. I tried to lure him to my house with meat, but he wouldn't budge. After days without food or water, he up and died. I couldn't figure it out. Just didn't make any sense. It does now. I won't leave Roan.
Certainly not in a place where Ivor still walks around.
Gifford patted the rock.
I had a better life than I should have. And I had more than 5 years of true happiness. That's enough. No, it's more than enough. I'm sorry. But you'll have to climb by yourself. You're a good man, Gifford.
She hugged him tightly. A very good man. No, you're a hero.
Bryn let him go and looked at the column's face, tilting her head back.
It seemed to go on forever. Gifford, don't tell the rest of them, but I'm scared. I don't know if I can do this.
You said you already tried a bit, and it was easy.
Not the climb,
but yeah, maybe that too. She frowned.
If I do make it, if I reach Allison, how will I cross it alone? And if I manage that, what challenges wait in the sacred grove? And I know nothing of Estramnodon. I honestly don't know what it is I'm supposed to do now. Tressa said I need to get a horn. But how do I do that? And even if I succeed, how can I ever get all the way back through Pyre? Nephril's bridge is gone. The queen will still want the key, and she'll know I have it. And what about Drome? There are so many obstacles still ahead of me. I'm not Moya. I'm not Persephone. I'm not like you or even Roan.
Bryn slapped her thigh in desperation.
Tressa would have been a far better choice than I. At least she has grit. All of you are so much more capable. I'm not smart. I can't fight. I'm not brave. I'm nothing. I shouldn't even have been included on this trip.
Gifford smirked. Before I got on Narrowspur, I was a cripple with a lisp whose biggest accomplishment was making pretty cups. So don't tell me you don't have what it takes to be a hero. No one had less clay to work with than the god who made me. You're the keeper. The best that there has ever been. Which means you know everything. You willingly drowned yourself to come here. So I think we can safely say that you're very, very brave. And do you think I wasn't scared when I rode out of Alenrith that night? I thought, no, I didn't think at all. I knew I'd die. What are you afraid of?
Falling? You've already done that. Dying? Done that too.
Not falling. Failing, Bryn said. If I do that, then all of your sacrifices will have been for nothing.
Gifford nodded.
Excellent point.
except you're going to succeed.
How do you know?
Malcolm said so. Bryn pretended to smile, but she knew the truth. Malcolm, Turin, Uberlin, no matter what name he went by, he was evil and manipulative. If by some miracle she did succeed, she would be playing into the hands of someone too nefarious to fully understand. Why should I do what he wants? So he can be trusted?
Giffard had asked Muriel. Her answer had been, as far as you're concerned, yes. It seems he wants you to succeed. And as I said, if Turin wants something, he usually gets it.
Bryn didn't know what to believe, and her thoughts were interrupted by a hug from Gifford. You're gonna be fine. Keep your focus on Suri. Remember, she's alone too. Once you two are together, you'll muddle through. I'm certain.
Sure, Bryn said, for Suri.
Gifford gave her another hug and kissed her cheek. I'm sorry I can't help, and that all of this has to fall on your shoulders. I'm sorry to let you down.
You didn't let me down, Gifford. None of you have. You all did your part.
She looked up. Now I have to do mine.
Bryn grabbed hold of the rock and pulled herself up. She jumped to a ledge and looked back at Gifford. And know this, Mr. Crippled Potter. I'm going to make you a legend in the Book of Bryn. You, Moya, Roan, Tekchin, Rain, Tressa, and Tesh, when I'm done, each of you will be more famous than Gath, Midian, and all the rest combined. People everywhere will remember you all as the heroes who saved the world.
I'd like that.
So would I, Bryn said.
So would I.
The climb didn't go as easily as she had expected. She wasn't weightless, and the ascent seemed to go on forever. The higher she went, the more fatigued she became, and the fewer ledges she found for resting. Time and distance couldn't be gauged with any degree of certainty. And there was the cold. While the abyss had been constantly freezing, the rock was more than icy. The stone seemed to steal heat from her. Not that she had much to give. The rests weren't just to stave off weariness, but to provide her fingers a chance to warm and recover. She knew they weren't real. But something hurt, and then went numb. When trying to latch onto little jagged outcrops, she preferred her hands to have feeling. Fear of falling should have been an issue, but it wasn't. She wasn't scared of hurting herself or dying. She just didn't want to start over. During her time in Nifril, Bryn had found nothing to appreciate, and everything in the abyss had been a misery. But climbing that pillar brought a whole new level of agony. In retrospect, she didn't think Gifford could have made it after all. Bryn guessed she was still quite far from the top. Instead of the light of the Queen's false sky, that winter haze, she saw only darkness beyond the reach of her light. And with some concern, she noticed that it wasn't as bright as it had been. When she'd first fallen into the abyss, Bryn guessed she illuminated an area roughly the size of Dol Ren, and the light was bright enough to make people shade their eyes. Now, as she pressed her back against the icy column's face, and her toes hung over a narrow lip the size of half a milking stool, she estimated that with this paltry light, she would have trouble doing needlework in a roundhouse. She was just so tired and heavy. Yes, I'm definitely heavier. Why is that? What makes me that way? Why now? As I get farther away from the base, shouldn't the weight decrease?
She wondered about that several times during the ascent. Toward the bottom, when she used to leap for handholds, she'd been fearless. And a fall wasn't anything to be concerned about. Now she no longer attempted jumps. During the climb, her thoughts kept returning to Tesh and whether he and the others would find a way out.
Deep down, she knew it wouldn't happen. How can it? Tressa can't even walk to the pillar, much less climb. And Tisha's and Round's treks to the tablets all but did them in. Every time she thought about Tesh trapped at the bottom, her heart reminded her it had been shattered. Sitting here won't help. That's what it wants. Bryn had come to think of the abyss as a living thing, where the term living was used in the broadest possible sense. She pictured it as the stomach of a beast that was digesting Tesh and everyone else. She was trying to claw her way out through its throat, and the creature kept swallowing. Each minute she remained, she got weaker. Lingering, even to gather her strength, only resulted in shrinking her reserves. Bryn reached up, groping for the next handhold, and wondering if it was possible for the rock to get even colder. It doesn't want me to get out. Those lost to the abyss are never seen again. And yet Trilus escaped. The thought came from nowhere, and it gave her the reserves to pull herself up another foot. Instead of focusing on the cold and difficulty of climbing, she concentrated on the tablets. Running them through her head, she worked to remember what she had learned, so she'd be able to include it all in the Book of Bryn. Some of the tablets spoke of brothers and sisters and their days of happiness and joy while wandering a garden of perfection. Other portions talked about the deceit of the dwarfs and the broken promises they made before eventually letting Trilos out. But most of what was written was a love story. Tablet after tablet was etched with thoughts of her. The author called the subject of his admiration really a nickname, a pet name, a secret name for Muriel, but really was treated with great care, both in the etching of the word on the tablets and in the respect paid her in the text. Bryn got the sense that the name had a double meaning, maybe more than one. This person was both real to him and the most real thing he knew. Included in the tablets was the tale of how they'd first met in a golden field on a spring morning. This scene had been explained in great detail, right down to a description of what Muriel had worn. Then there were whole tablets devoted to nothing but random thoughts about her or snippets of conversation the two had shared. She has a gap between her two upper front teeth that she can make an ear-piercing whistle through, but she thinks it's improper to do so. There's a sizable freckle on the top of her left ear, and she almost always drools when she sleeps. She's always using the phrase, when trees walk and stones talk, when she's frustrated about something that will never happen. Pondering why Malcolm thought that one line was so important kept her mind occupied for what seemed like hours while she climbed. Why is it so important for me to know that Trilos and Muriel were in love? There has to be something I'm missing. Didn't he know that Beatrice would tell me about the two of them? He knew I had read the tablets when I was here with Persephone. Was he counting on me remembering that line? Funny thing is, I didn't see that phrase back then. I only found it when I was searching the tablets for a way out. And now that I have, what does it matter? She still didn't know what to think about Malcolm. His divinity, if that was the right word, was no longer in question, but what he was up to was still a mystery. Malcolm isn't an idiot. He must have known that by coming down here, I would learn the truth about him. He'd always appeared so genuine, unassuming, and supportive, especially regarding her Book of Bryn. It sounds wonderful, this idea of making a permanent record of everything that's happened. But you need to be careful. Don't allow personal opinion to distort facts. He'd said that the last time they met, back in Alan Rist, after the Battle of Granford. She thought he was talking about her own opinions. but maybe he was trying to warn her about the negative comments Malcolm's siblings and daughter would make. She pulled herself up another 2 feet and found what was becoming an increasingly rare sight, a ledge. She didn't pause there. Keeping her mind busy was helping her forget the trials of the climb. Unable to unravel the mystery that was Malcolm, she focused once more on Trilos and his writings about Reilly. Why did Trilos devote such an enormous amount of time and effort to jotting down trivialities about the love of his life? Was it boredom, longing, or something else? There were dozens of tablets filled with insignificant details about this woman, and more devoted to his love for her. He described how a mere smile from Muriel had the power to erase a whole day of misfortunes, how tears in her eyes made him physically ill. No detail was too small. He poured his feelings for her onto the tablet. But why? Bryn felt she was missing something. Something important. And how did he escape? If Pyre is able to hold the Typhons, where did Trilos find the power to punch through worlds? Pins and needles in her fingertips were becoming an agony once more, and Bryn took a brief rest even without a ledge. Fatigue of spirit translated into sore arms that quivered as she pulled on them, and watery legs that protested when pushing up. Weight continued to increase, and her light had dimmed by more than half. She realized Giffert was probably now brighter. Air moved. Startled, Bryn looked around. Wind? At no point in all of Pyre had she felt a breeze. The Abyss doesn't want me to escape. Bryn clutched the stone. Flattening her body as best she could, she clung to the column as the wind brushed by. Her hair whipped, but the air had a hard time getting a grip on her. Eventually, its icy fingers found a hold, pulling her back from the pillar, jerking first left, then right. The wind is actually trying to rip me off. Bryn shifted around, working to get to the lee side, but this was no ordinary gale. The wind followed her, clawing harder. She hugged the rock, her fingers frosting with the relentless blow of freezing gusts. She pressed a cheek against the pillar's face. Her entire body trembled from stress and exertion. Bryn searched for another handhold. She had to keep moving upward, for her light was fading faster, reduced to little more than a candle's flame. A lonely flicker. She could feel the hopelessness seeping in, stealing her strength. I'm not strong enough. Tressa was right. No one can cheat death. She squeezed her eyes shut and fought against the growing weakness. Then she realized. Trilos cheated death. But how? Where did that power come from? The wind gusted and howled and nearly tore her off the pillar. She shifted her weight, finding a better spot, a larger foothold. It wouldn't matter. Bryn could feel her muscles failing. Soon she wouldn't have the strength to hold on. Before long, she'd let go. I'm sorry, she cried. But the wind stole her words, too. While her failure was a blow, the knowledge that she'd convinced Tesh to die for nothing was so much worse. Bryn felt the weight even more than before. Her light flickered dangerously low. The disappointment of her failure was bitter, her remorse palpable. Regret. Regret is the weight. Her foot slipped, and Bryn cried out from the pain in her hands as she fought to hold on. She was panting in fear, huffing against the rock. The dangling foot was as heavy as if a weight were tied to it. She couldn't pull it up. How did Trilos escape? Bryn concentrated on that, feeling there had to be a clue, something she could use. She has a gap between her two upper front teeth that she can make an ear-piercing whistle through.
but she thinks it's improper to do so. There's a sizable freckle on the top of her left ear. He wrote as if he didn't want to forget even the most trivial detail. Trilos was recording his memories. He was making his own Book of Bryn. He was being a keeper, but not of a people and their deeds. He was recording the specifics of the one he loved.
Why?
Why do I write? Bryn thought for a moment.
Because I don't want to forget anything. I'm trying to preserve what I've learned for the future, but I'm also writing about the people I love, so they won't be lost when I die. But he was already dead, so why would he sacrifice?
Gods demanded it. So did the art when making dragons. The greater the sacrifice, the stronger the power.
Then Bryn understood the horrible truth of it all. She realized where the power had come from to punch through worlds and create Belgargaroth. That's how he got out. He sacrificed her.
That's what I have to do too.
Bryn shook as she clung to the pillar. She finally understood.
Tesh is my weight.
The mere thought allowed her to replace her foot and relieve the pressure on her hands.
I have to let him go, but how can I do that?
She couldn't forget Tesh any more than she could forget
what he did.
The wind shrieked in her ears and clawed at her face.
No, the weight isn't what I've done to Tesh. That's not how it works. The weight comes from me.
Bryn's breath deteriorated to short gasps.
What do I have to let go of?
She lost footing again, and this time the sudden movement pulled both feet free. She hung only from her fingertips as the wind whipped, pulling, then slapping her dangling body against the rock. Yet she hardly felt it. Her mind was hard at work, searching for the answer.
Love can't be a weight, but do I love him? Can I love a murderer? Should I? I was able to forgive Tressa, but can I forgive Tesh? Can I truly and completely forgive him for luring Anwyr out into the forest and killing him slowly? Can I just look past all the Galentians he murdered? How can I forget that he pretended to be their comrade while plotting their deaths?
The wind went to work on her fingertips, biting with icy teeth.
None of the Galentians were innocent, she reminded herself. They had murdered his family, his whole clan. And for what reason? To start a war where thousands of truly innocent people died. But do their murders excuse Tesh's? No. That's his weight, not mine. He has to deal with that. All I need to address is how I feel after knowing what he did. My weight is my judgment.
The wind whipped into a fury, and the cold raised a frost on the stone, turning it white. But still, Bryn hung on.
My regret, my failure, is that I never truly forgave him. Not really. That weight is mine to carry, or mine to let go. Who am I to judge him? Was I there? Am I him? Who granted me the right to arbitrate the transgressions of others?
The moment the thought entered, the second she gave it room, she realized she wasn't an authority on the matter. She hadn't killed anyone, never even helped her father slaughter a sheep. But she had made mistakes, and was far from perfect. She could have seen the good in Tressa years before. If she had, Tressa might not have turned out to be the bitter woman she grew into.
I could have been a better friend to Moya and Padera, and most of all, to Rome. And I certainly could have been a better daughter.
And then there was her uncle Gelston. The lightning strike had left him enfeebled.
If ever he had needed his family, it was then. But she had avoided him out of fear. She was his niece, the only living family he had, and she did nothing for him. Only Tressa, the doll's anointed evil one, took care of him. She was kinder to Bryn's uncle than Bryn was herself. Yes, she'd made mistakes. Like anyone. Everyone fell, some harder and farther than others, but who am I to judge?
I forgive you, Tesh, she said aloud. And I'm sorry for taking so damn long to do it.
Just then, Bryn had no choice but to close her eyes. If she hadn't, she would have been blinded by her own light. Chapter 10 Yellow and Rose. Some homes are haunted by spirits. Some spirits are haunted by homes. The Book of Bryn. Suri put a heel of the loaf of the dark bread into her bag and added a wedge of orange cheese. She'd always had a fondness for little pouches. Big bags encouraged carrying too much. Little ones invited the gathering of such wonders as polished pebbles, colourful leaves, string, animal teeth, or shiny pieces of metal. Suri didn't have much treasures anymore, but the cheese and bread would do. What are you doing? Margareta asked. She was working on her sculpture again, her hands caked with clay. Going for a walk? Macaretta's brows rose. Oh, the old lady's not going to like that. I can't continue staying inside. Makes me crazy. I think it drives everyone a little nuts. Suri gave Margareta an insinuating smile and then glanced at the phrase mouse slippers. Margareta replied with a smirk. You went out? Suri said. I had to, Margareta replied, dipping her fingers into a bowl of water and letting the runoff drip on the heads of the statuette. I had to invite Mondelez to the meeting. I have to go out too. Where are you going? I only ask because Imali will want to know where to look for the body. Margareta smiled back. Mine or my victims? Ha, ha, Margareta said, impersonating a laugh. Seriously, be careful. She looked over her shoulder at a blank wall, as if she could see through it. There's a lot of scared people out there. She meant that there were a lot of Frey who might think hurting a rune would make them feel less frightened. I can take care of myself, Suri replied, as she slung the bag's drawstring over her head so that the pouch hung under her arm. Margareta tapped her own neck. Collar, remember. No one is supposed to know. Suri reached up and touched the metal band around her neck. She'd worn it for so long she'd forgotten it was there. I grew up among wolves, bears, rau, leshies, green apples, and really nasty picker bushes. I was able to handle all those things long before I knew the art. As long as I don't bump into Mondelez, everything will be fine. He's not the only Miralith in the city. Suri shook her head. That's not the problem. Margareta frowned. Be nice. He'll be the next Fane and my husband. And I'd like you two to be friends. Suri chuckled. Oh, that's not going to happen. Fine, be that way. And here I was, planning to invite you to the wedding. Guess it wouldn't be appropriate now that I know you want to kill my fiancé. Could be awkward. Suri started toward the door. Arion's house is north. It's been empty since she left. Easiest way to go is through the garden, which is pretty empty this time of year. Head up the widest street out of the plaza, then straight through the garden. Follow the street and you'll see it. A little house with a bright blue door. What makes you think I'm going there? I didn't. But where else would you go? It's not like you have a lot of friends in Estramnadon. Good point, Suri said.
Don't be too long, Margareta called after her. When you get back, we'll play a string game.
Suri would have liked a real walk, one that would take her into the forest, but she guessed that wasn't such a good idea. She had to get out, needed to know she could, but she wasn't trying to escape. As much as she longed to disappear into the arms of the trees, she knew better than to risk everything. Imali had called for the meeting, setting everything in motion. Suri could afford to wait one more day. Regardless of how things turned out, the world was going to be very different. It looked and felt like snow was on the way, and there weren't many Frey wandering around. Those who were out and about took little notice of her passing. From a distance, and while wearing the assegai and a borrowed cloak, she looked much as they did. A light snow did begin to fall as she moved through the plaza, leaving a thin film of white dust on the street. Suri followed a fresh set of single prints, which were joined by another. Suri knew how to read tracks, and these were especially easy. One small, the other large, male and female. Suri enjoyed the walk between the house and the garden, even though it was short. It felt good to stretch her legs and to see the world. Even the cold spray of snow against her cheeks was nice. She remembered such wintry kisses from her childhood, when she played wild and free in a forest full of grand adventures. Her world had grown, and her adventures were bigger by far, but somehow less grand. Everything was that way. Duller, greyer, smaller. She had gained the power of magic, but this had only served to render the world less enchanting. Suri knew Arion's home the moment she saw it, a bit off the road and mostly shaded by a tree. It would be beautiful in spring. The place was small, delicate, and unassuming. The front door was unlatched. She stood there, listening to the flakes fall, working up the courage to push the door open. She had no idea what she would find. Nothing, most likely. Yet Suri was afraid, without knowing why. The interior was musty. She found a pegboard where a hooded cape hung. Suri touched it, rubbed the thick material between her fingers. Probably put it there on her way out. In the center of the first room, a small round table stood covered in dust. After running her finger over its surface and removing the grime, she found it had been polished to a fine gloss. A vase sat in the middle. Long dead flowers had rotted away. She could see the remains of them, like shadows on the side of the vase, marring the existing design. Chairs were pushed under the table and carefully spaced. Light came through open shutters, framed by yellow drapes, making the room bright and cheerful. The walls were painted a festive rose color, and a plush carpet matched the drapes' sunny disposition. Suri's toe caught an edge of the rug. She took a moment to smooth the corner back down and straighten the tassels. How long has it been since Arion was here? Did she suspect she would never return? A half-moon arch led to a room with a high bed topped by a pretty canopy. The thick mattress was covered by a wonderful quilt with embroidered flowers in the color of, what else? Yellow and rose. Suri ran her hand over the cloth that was still beautiful despite being shrouded in dust. Inside closets, several colorful assegais hung, one with pretty blue piping. She would have looked beautiful in that. Suri made sure to close the closet door before sitting on the bed. Arion's world was so soft, perfect, and bright. When Suri had first met Arion, the Frey had been lying on Persephone's bed in a dark, smoky lodge, bleeding and hurting. How horrible that must have been after this. After a world of yellow and rose, a place of sunlight and softness. Suri reached into her bag and felt around until she touched the knit hat. When Suri was captured, she thought it had been lost forever. Imali had no way of knowing how much giving it back had meant. The gift, that tiny gesture, had made all the difference. Suri held it to her face and breathed in. The scent of Arion was gone from the wool, and Suri laid it on the bed beside her. She pressed it out, making it lie flat. "You're home," she said, and for the first time since being lied to, captured, dragged across the Frey's lands, imprisoned, buried alive, and forced to give up a terrible secret, Suri cried. Even fewer Frey were out by the time Suri left Arion's home. All around, windows were shuttered against the cold. After reaching the garden's gate, only Suri and her shadow remained. Suri followed the curving path around the snow-covered bushes until she came to a set of benches across from a whitewashed door. Surprisingly, someone was there. Suri hadn't noticed anyone her first time through. Yet, here was a person in a dingy robe with a hood pulled up, sitting across from the door.
"Do you know how long before it opens?"
Suri stopped, and the hood tilted upward to look at her. She shook her head.
Shoulders slumped.
"Neither do I. But I think we're getting close. Very close now."
Beneath the hood was an odd face. Youthful, yet old. Friendly and frightening. Innocent and guilty. All of the contradictions were built upon one another, and he stared back at her with a pleasant smile. Suri didn't know why, but she was certain his question wasn't as simple as it seemed to be.
"You're Suri, is that right?"
She nodded, even though she assumed he wasn't actually questioning her identity. She was, after all, the only rune in the city, the only one on that side of the Nidwalden, for that matter.
"How did you learn to make the sentinel?"
"The what?" she asked.
"What everyone calls a dragon."
"Oh," Suri said, and relaxed a bit, realizing this person was just the curious type.
"Anyone would be, I suppose. Even I would ask a deer about how it managed to climb a tree."
Given that Neith was buried, she didn't see any point in hiding the facts. "I found instructions on a stone tablet under a Derg city."
"You are in Leargave?"
Suri was surprised he knew the name, but didn't find it alarming. She assumed a lot of people in the wider world knew about many places she didn't. Perhaps Leargave was as famous as Pyre.
"Yes. Was there a... Did you encounter...
He made gestures for something large with his hands. "Balgargareth?"
"Yes. I'm guessing that's what the Derg named it?"
She nodded. He became intensely interested and leaned toward her.
"What happened?"
"We destroyed it." Suri expected the next question to be how, but she wouldn't answer. Not only was it painfully personal, but given that she'd already provided Lothian with the secrets to making and destroying dragons, she felt she had said all she needed to on that subject.
"So, you found Hilda Ragosna Rodaha's name?"
Suri stopped breathing. Seeing her face, he nodded.
"Yes, I made him."
He paused.
"Not actually a him, so much as an it. Just a thing, really."
How did you do it?" The irony of her own question pushed her to add,
"I know how. But what did you use to reach the deep chords? You must have sacrificed someone important. But weren't you alone?"
"I doubt you understand half of what you're asking." A shadow crossed his face as he looked back at the door. He didn't speak for quite some time. Then he said, "I wasn't alone. I still had my memories."
"You sacrificed your memories? How?"
"You simply erase them, the way you do anything else. The cords of creation can destroy as well as create. You pull the threads and alter the pattern of the weave that makes you who you are."
"And that's enough?"
He looked at her surprised, even a bit appalled.
"Sacrificing the life of a loved one is horrible. But through your memories, a part of them lives on. You can still talk to them, share stories with others, and sometimes they visit you in dreams. During those comforting moments, it's as if they are with you again. But removing their memories erases everything."
Afterward, it is painless, but the act is beyond horrific. You aren't killing the person you love. You're killing your love for the person. Because love is one of the most powerful things in the universe, breaking it like that is... Yes, it's more than enough. What memory did you erase? He laughed, a sad chuckle.
How would I know?
He stopped staring at the door and shook off his melancholy. I must say, I'm impressed you were able to defeat my sentinel. He looked nasty.
It wasn't...
She was going to say easy, but couldn't. She searched for another word, but found none. Anything she came up with trivialized the horror she had gone through, the twin nightmares she still suffered. She considered whether she should hate this person. He had created the creature, and because he did, she had been forced to...
No, I can't pass on that blame. I killed Mina. No one else. I have to be the one to live with that. The memory is painful, and yet, he's right. At least I still remember her.
Never mind, the fellow in the hood said, and waved her off. I understand. We all do what we have to when the time comes, and we hope that in the end everything will work out such that our sacrifices will be worth the cost. But the future is a fickle thing, and you never really know what it will bring. She nodded. You haven't asked who I am,
should I?
He shrugged. Most people do.
What do you tell them?
I give them a name that means nothing.
You're the Ancient One.
He thought about this and nodded, his lower lip judging the pronouncement. I guess that works. I am old, and I am one. When he said nothing more, Suri started to walk past. Then she stopped and glanced at the little door.
You've been waiting for that door to open for a long time, haven't you?
Yes.
What will you do when it does?
A smile formed, and the fellow on the bench laughed softly to himself. I'll go in.
Chapter 11. Allison. Allison is the sort of place only a child can believe in. The longer you live, the more you know it cannot exist. The Book of Bryn. Reaching the top of the pillar, and once more beneath a hazy grey sky, Bryn saw that the bridge across the abyss really had been torn apart. It shouldn't have been a surprise. It wasn't that she doubted what Tesh had told her, but it was shocking to see. Not surprisingly, the armies, the queen, the bankors, and the dragon were also gone. Bryn couldn't say she was disappointed about their absence. Others might have previously walked to where she now stood, when there was a bridge. But being the first to scale her way to it from the abyss gave her the feeling of authority over the place. Like some grand explorer, she officially renamed it the Pillar of Lost Regret. She felt she deserved the privilege. Anyone else in Nephril would have named it after themselves. Phenaleus was right. I don't belong here. Looking out at the desolate